Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, March 21st, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. Railroad tracks that affect thousands of people a day will be studied to see if there are solutions to make the community safer, healthier, and more equitable. Waterloo received a $750,000 federal grant for a study on the relocation of the downtown railroad yard to the Northeast Industrial Park on the outskirts of town, as well as other safety improvements. The money comes from the Neighborhood Access and Equity Program from the Federal Office of the Secretary of Transportation. The study will look into the Canadian National Rail Yard, its rail lines leading into the yard and railroad crossings, and its effect on the surrounding neighborhoods. It is confined to the geographic area bounded by East Donald Street, North Elk Run Road, Martin Luther King Jr. Drive, Franklin Street, and East Mullen Avenue, U.S. Highway 63. The grant application was written by the Iowa Northland Regional Council of Governments, known as INRCOG, located in Waterloo. The Neighborhood Access and Equity Program is aimed at correcting the infrastructure choices of the past, Aldina Dautovic, an INRCOG transportation planner, said, and that's exactly what this is. INRCOG worked with the city to write the grant with a focus on social equity. The $750,000 is only for the study. Once a study is completed, the city can apply for another grant for implementation of its suggestions. The INRCOG transportation planning team said the study could take up to 2 years to complete. Kyle Durant, the other transportation planner with INRCOG, said the study has a multitude of issues to look at, including the history of the rail industry, potentially contaminated soil, and the relocation of a massive amount of infrastructure while maintaining Canadian National's business to transport goods across the country. If the rail yard is moved, the study would also look into how the city could improve the area and neighborhoods where the tracks sit. It's literally a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to look at this, Nick Fratsky, INRCOG's Director of Transportation, said. We really have to make sure that it is done right. In the nearly 100-page application, the government entities said there are many issues caused by downtown rail lines. These include a physical divide between neighborhoods north and south of the tracks, negative health and environmental effects, safety concerns, and disruptions in everyday life. Durant said the location is at the heart of a historically disadvantaged community, which a lot of these funds are targeted for, so it was a prime project to go after these funds. Statistics from the U.S. Council on Environmental Quality show the neighborhoods, especially the neighborhood known as Smoky Row, a triangular area bounded by Sumner Street, Mobile Street, and the railroad tracks at East 4th Street and Douglas Street, have multiple burns. The grant application stated the average residential property value in Smoky Row is $57,000. This is 58% lower than the citywide average property value of nearly $137,000. INRCOG said this contributes to generational wealth gaps. The organization also said many people do not want to move to the area due to the air and noise pollution, safety concerns from the railroad, the aesthetics of industrial facilities, and the constant movement of trains. This results in a decline in residential property values. Air pollution, which includes particulate matter, diesel emissions, and nitrogen oxides, are extremely high in the area. Smoky Row is in the 97th percentile for toxic releases, the 96th percentile for particulate matter, the 92nd percentile for diesel particulate matter, and the 91st percentile for air toxic cancer risks. A lawsuit claimed from 1991 to 2018, at least five people have lost limbs while trying to climb through a stopped train that started to move. In 2019, another woman suffered traumatic injuries after being hit by a train. He said the blockages alone create disadvantages that affect the quality of life. The area has been and continues to have a large black population. Many African Americans moved to Waterloo in the early 1900s to work on the railroad. However, they were hired for the jobs while the rail workers' union was on strike, resulting in hostility. Other past racist practices, such as covenants, kept black residents in the Smoky Row area. The grant said these issues contribute to the racial disparities that continue to exist in the city. The grant is one of few sources of funding that has come to the area that could reinvest and redevelop the neighborhood, Waterloo Mayor Quentin Hart said. The study could look at walkability, new housing, and safety. Hart and Intercog said the money won't just affect the residents, but it could affect Canadian National as well. If moved to the Northeast Industrial Park area, the railroad would be closer to arterial roads, nearby businesses such as Tyson and John Deere, and would have the ability to create a newer facility. The money was recently awarded, and the city has yet to decide on a consultant for the project. The decision would have to be approved by the city council. Hart said he will continue to have conversations with representatives from Canadian National, who he said have been very supportive of the project. Intercog said community engagement will also be a big part of the study. A Waterloo man has been arrested for allegedly attempting to set fire to an apartment he was in the process of leaving in December. Anthony Kyle O'Donnell, 36, pleaded to a reduced charge of third-degree arson, as well as burglary and criminal mischief, and on Monday he was sentenced to up to 5 years in prison during a hearing in Black Hawk County District Court. He was also ordered to pay restitution, which will be determined at a later date. Authorities said O'Donnell was moving out of an apartment at 219 Parkview Boulevard and had already turned over the keys December 9th when police were called to the disturbance at the building. Police said O'Donnell had broken open the apartment door, destroyed a Samsung TV, and poured a clear liquid on the kitchen and dining room floors, as well as on a backpack. He then lit pot holders and the backpack and placed them on the liquid in an attempt to light it. The fire apparently put itself out without spreading. People were home at another apartment at the time, police said. A Waterloo man has been arrested after allegedly attacking his ex-girlfriend and her new boyfriend Monday morning. Police arrested Jude Richard Beck, 43, of 621 West 9th Street for willful injury causing bodily injury, assault while displaying a weapon, fourth-degree criminal mischief, and public intoxication. Bond was set at $15,000. Authorities allege Beck struck his ex-girlfriend with a 2x4 board in the back and back of the head during an argument around 2:40 a.m. at 411 Sumner Street. When the woman's new boyfriend stepped in to intervene, Beck hit him in the head with a baseball bat and then broke windows on the woman's vehicle, according to court records. Beck walked off, and officers found him a short time later at East 4th and Sumner Streets. The bat was found along his path, records state. Two Waterloo women have been arrested after a police raid for synthetic marijuana uncovered unsanitary conditions at their house. Officers with the Waterloo Police Department executed a search warrant at 422 Dane Street on March 7th for suspected K2, which they found along with a digital scale. But authorities also found dog feces in most of the rooms, drugs on the floor, and trash bags piled up. Children ages 3 months and 1 year also were living in the house. On Friday, police arrested Aviana Ashante Smith, 22, and Montana Lynn Eifert, 22, for misdemeanor child endangerment. Smith was also arrested for possession of synthetic marijuana with intent to deliver. Both were released pending trial. A Waterloo man has been arrested for allegedly hitting a woman with a vehicle and driving off over the weekend. Witnesses told police they saw a Chevrolet Equinox SUV strike a pedestrian in the 200 block of Leland Avenue around 6:40 p.m. Saturday. The vehicle then drove off. Paramedics with Waterloo Fire Rescue took the woman to the hospital for possible hip and head injuries. Witnesses identified the driver as Kevin Prosper Janu Jr. On Monday, police arrested Janu, 36, of 3031 University Avenue for assault causing serious injury and leaving the scene of an injury accident. Bond was set at $25,000. Reconstruction soon will begin on a road many residents have been asking the city to fix. Part of Broadway Street from Donald Street to the U.S. Highway 218 ramp will be rebuilt this spring. The City Council on Monday approved a $4.8 million contract with Cedar Valley Corporation of Waterloo. The 2-mile stretch of roadway is expected to be completed by this winter. Jamie Knutson, the city's engineer, estimated the project would cost $6.7 million. Since the accepted bid is almost $2 million less, he said more of the street may be worked on under this contract. Any additions to the contract would have to be voted on by the council. One resident asked why a portion of San Marnan Drive was completed before Broadway, saying more people complain about the latter. Knutson said that the two projects were originally bid together, but the city wasn't satisfied with the bids. When they opened up bids again, he said there wouldn't have been enough time in the construction year for Broadway to have been done before winter. There will be two other phases of the reconstruction. One will go from Highway 218 to the airport exit, and the other from Donald Street to Burton Avenue. The detours and traffic changes are still being worked out. In other business, the council approved a $1 development agreement with Iowa Heartland Habitat for Humanity for the construction of a home near 216 Sunnyside Avenue with a $5,000 infill housing grant. A bid by Peterson Contractors Incorporated for $631,153 for the reconstruction of Kingsley Avenue. The final plat of the North Crossing addition, which includes a 14-lot commercial subdivision between Logan Avenue and East 4th Street, and a development agreement with Net Worth Investment LLC for the construction of a 10-unit residential building near 2557 West 3rd Street, which includes a $50,000 infill incentive upon completion. Black Hawk County property owners will begin receiving mailings this week from the County Auditor's Office with information about budget hearings and property taxes. A recent law change requires counties to mail a statement to county taxpayers by March 20th with state-specified information related to proposed local governmental budgets and proposed property tax rates. The information is for taxes payable in September 2024 and March 2025. Property owners should receive a statement if they expect to receive a property tax bill in September. The statement is not a bill. It includes data for proposed cities, school district, and county budgets, but does not include proposed budgets for smaller taxing authorities such as the community college, assessor's office, townships, and agricultural extension service. The purpose of the statement is to provide taxpayers with information about the proposed city, school district, and county budgets in time for the taxpayers to address the proposals at public hearings held before the budgets are approved. The date, time, and location of the hearings are included in the statements. The budgets may be lowered after the hearing, but cannot be raised. Included in the statement is the impact of the proposed city, school, and county property tax rates on both a $100,000 residential property and $100,000 commercial property. The actual tax impact on a property could be different than the examples in the statement because they do not factor any possible change in assessed value. Many Black Hawk County property owners saw growth in assessed value in 2023, which is not reflected in the calculation. Taxpayers owning more than one property may receive multiple letters if those properties are in different tax districts. The Iowa Department of Management is providing information on how to interpret the mailing online at dom.iowa.gov/property-taxes. For further information, call the auditor's office at 319-833-3058. Two people have been arrested in connection with a fight at a rural LaPorte City home in February. Black Hawk County Sheriff's deputies on Tuesday arrested Nicholas James Johnson, 38, and Richard Owen Bush, 50, both of 10802 Harmon Road, for first-degree burglary. Bond was set at $25,000 each. The two allegedly went to a house at 9207 Garling Road around 7 p.m. February 22nd. Johnson allegedly punched a man in the driveway. He and Bush then entered a garage to fight others, according to court records. One person suffered a dislocated shoulder during the altercation and was treated at the hospital in Independence. Three others were also injured. In Waverly, the City Council gave its final stamp of approval for automatic speed and traffic cameras on Monday. The ordinance allowing for their installation passed 5-2 on its final of three readings. Council members Rodney Drenko and Tim Kangas dissented. Subsequently, the council approved in a 6-1 vote a master services agreement for Genoptic Smart Mobility Solutions of Jupiter, Florida, to provide the technology services for at least 5 years. Kangas opposed. 4th Street Southwest will be the initial focus, specifically at the intersections of 29th, 10th, and Bremer Avenues, where sensors will capture images of vehicles speeding, but also running red lights and not yielding to pedestrians when they have the right of way. Traffic light and pedestrian violations will be tagged with $100 fines. Speed violations will start at 11 to 20 miles per hour above the limit at $75, 21 to 25 miles per hour at $100, 26 to 30 miles per hour at $150, and 31 miles per hour or more at $200. Genoptic will collect 35% of all fines as part of its service agreement with the city. The violations will not affect a person's driving record or insurance. Offenders will receive notice through the mail and have the option to pay them online. In news from Cedar Falls, the contractors have been identified for two big upcoming road projects this spring and summer. The City Council unanimously voted Monday to award construction contracts to Dave Schmidt Construction of Cedar Rapids and ASPRO of Waterloo for the North Cedar Heights Area Reconstruction and Annual Street Restoration Program, respectively, at lower than expected costs. Dave Schmidt's work was the lowest of four bids at $3.61 million, or 17.39% lower than the budgeted estimate of $4.37 million. ASPRO's work was the only bid at $1.02 million, or 34.62% below the budgeted estimate of $1.56 million. The project drew little council discussion. Councilman Dustin Ganfield initiated the loan exchange by noting the low costs compared to last year's road projects. He went one step further, feeling politically inclined to point out to his colleagues how the two contracts were a lesson, in his mind, in how prices can come down. Ganfield brought up the Main Street reconstruction project and how he and two others voted against awarding the contract in late 2022 when the loan bid was approximately 40% over the estimate. "I wish we had a crystal ball," said Council Member Gil Schultz in defending his vote of approval. "Hindsight is 2020. The North Cedar Heights contract will mark the second of five phases of work north of Grand Boulevard and west of the Hartman Reserve. This year's work will touch Timber Drive from Grand Avenue to Greenwood Avenue, East Ridgewood Drive from Greenwood Avenue to Cherry Lane, and Woodland Drive from a dead end to East Ridgewood Avenue. In addition to new asphalt, the area will see infrastructure like storm and sanitary sewer, water mains, and gutters replaced. This year's street restoration will impact Linden Avenue from Delta Drive to Hudson Road, Laurel Circle from Hudson Road to Clark Drive, Nordic Drive from a dead end to 500 feet past Westminster Drive, Grand Boulevard from Timber Drive to River Hills School Drive, Lone Tree Road from Ford Road to Hiawatha Road, and Greenhill Road from Hudson Road to Ashworth Drive. That work includes new asphalt as well as other improvements like pedestrian ramp replacements. A game plan has been agreed upon for coming up with new zoning to revitalize College Hill. The City Council unanimously agreed Monday to the Community Development Department's proposal for implementing the previously approved Imagine College Hill visioning document. The first step will be selecting a consultant to aid in what's anticipated to be at least 2 years' worth of work. Council members voted no objections and heard from two key stakeholders who expressed appreciation for what looks to be progress. No action has been taken on the plan for 2 years. A council majority had concerns about zoning that could be implemented if the Imagine College Hill plan is executed. The visioning document was rescinded in a 4-3 vote before the November election, but was readopted last month in a 5-2 vote after three new council members were seated. Community Development Director Stephanie Schietzend said her department will roll out a request for qualifications seeking a consultant to assist in developing the new code. A firm could be hired as soon as this summer using part of $100,000 set aside for College Hill zoning. The Imagine College Hill plan is likely to be tweaked. It was first approved in May 2021. Future zoning would focus on the commercial district and adjacent neighborhoods. Part of the process would look at the requirements within the current overlay district, which is on top of the traditional zones. Jim Brown, Executive Director of the Cedar Falls Economic Development Corporation, and Chris Martin, Interim Board President of the College Hill Partnership, were among those expressing appreciation for getting started on the process. They hope it will create a better set of rules, attracting new development and business. Brown encouraged council members not to get hung up on parking decisions and to trust the process, as well as the city's staff and Planning and Zoning Commission, all of whom will play a role with the consultant in finally getting any new zoning to the finish line. Council member Daryl Cruz cautioned that a consultant should bring back options incorporating all types of zoning. He and Councilman Dustin Ganfield voted against full adoption of the vision plan last month as they went from being in the majority to the minority on the issue in 2024. When we look at consultants to choose from and send out requests for proposals, we have a broad range of thoughts on whether we should have traditional zoning or Euclidean zoning or form-based zoning versus what many call a hybrid of multiple components of each, he said. And I think it's important we get a consultant that can cover all those and not just be one or the other. Some of the council members had accused the city's past downtown consultant, Farrell Madden, of only presenting form-based zoning in and around Main Street as part of downtown's overhaul. The same consulting firm assisted in putting together the College Hill vision, but has since disbanded. Others say that what was presented for downtown was the will of the community and a result of lengthy visioning and processes spawning many months. One notable effort will be striking a balance with fees, accessibility, and neighborhood impact when it comes to looking at the public parking policy of the city and University of Northern Iowa, but also private parking requirements for new development. Sheetson noted that other tools as well, like bringing about fees in lieu of providing the required private parking with new building, so you're putting into a fund to create more public parking. She also noted the possibility of a task force or committee being assembled to assist the discussions on parking. Additionally, the city will look into more standardized objective requirements for new building, as well as removing simpler undertakings from burdensome processes. All conversations that mirror those officials had while crafting new downtown zoning adopted in late 2021. The consultant won't handle non-zoning initiatives related to College Hill's revitalization, but the council came to a consensus Monday on moving ahead with those department recommendations, such as continued code enforcement and opportunities for more trees and wider sidewalks. Council members also asked for an ordinance allowing for accessory dwelling units in the residential areas of College Hill. The Cedar Falls Board of Education approved a series of policies Tuesday, including a requirement every building be equipped with EpiPens, epinephrine auto-injectors used to treat severe allergic reactions. These are the second reading of the 7 board policies that were needing to be changed due to legislation, court decisions that have recently happened across the state of Iowa or nationally, and our best practices that we are trying to align to, Superintendent Andy Patty told the board. Really, one of those best practices is the administering of stock prescription by providing EpiPens to each of our buildings. The policy also requires each school to have a dose of an opioid antagonist, such as Narcan, to treat drug overdose. That was approved in a previous policy update from 2022. Other board policies updated Tuesday concerned equal employment opportunities, staffing matters from recruitment to reassignment and transfer, student discipline related to threats of or incidents of violence, vendor and contractor procedures, procurement contracts, and distribution of literature. In other business, the board awarded a $172,668 contract to Martin Brothers of Cedar Falls to supply toilet paper and other custodial supplies during 2024-25, and held a public hearing for the 24-25 school year calendar, which will be approved at a future meeting. The school year will start on the earliest possible date allowed in Iowa Code, August 23rd, with the last day on May 30th, 2025. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, March 21st, 2024 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. James B. Porter, Jr. was born March 9, 1943 in Waterloo. He graduated from West High School and Aerospace Engineering at Iowa State University. Jim's engineering career was marked by hard work and dedication, having worked at Dorfer Engineering, Waterloo Industries, John Deere of Waterloo, and SIG Manufacturing of Montezuma. His expertise and passion for his work shone through all his endeavors. Aside from his professional accomplishments, Jim served 2 years with active duty service in the U.S. Naval Reserves. He also had a deep love for aviation and flying, achieving his private pilot's license. Jim had a love for radio-controlled model airplanes. He was a member of the Waterloo Black Hawk RC pilots and the Des Moines Model Airs. On March 16th, Jim passed away at Iowa Methodist Medical Center in Des Moines. He was a proud organ and tissue donor and through his donation with Iowa Donor Network. In keeping with Jim's wishes, no services are planned at this time. Memorials may be directed to, in Jim's memory, to Air Power Museum in Ottumwa. Dwayne Harmon McDonald, 73, died March 18th at Pinnacle Specialty Care in Cedar Falls from complications of Parkinson's disease. He was born January 15, 1951 in Kansas City, Missouri, and then graduated from Raytown High School in Kansas City, then earned his bachelor's degree from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and his master's degree from the University of Missouri in Columbia. Dwayne served in the U.S. Army Reserve from 1971 to 77. He moved to Davenport and later to Cedar Falls, where he was employed by Riverview Park as conference director and then the University of Northern Iowa as director of conferences and visitor services for many years. Dwayne married Sandra Baker in June 1975. They were later divorced, and he married Julie Hook in August 2010. Dwayne enjoyed watching sports and loved music and was active in the Cedar Falls Community Theater, performing on stage and providing support behind the scenes. Dwayne chose to be cremated. Dahl Van Hove Schoof in Cedar Falls is handling the arrangements. A celebration of life will be held Sunday, April 14th at 2 p.m. in the Deary Room, third floor, at the Cedar Falls Community Theater. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the CFCT. Timothy Joe Knipp passed away March 12th. He was born on March 17, 1957 in Waterloo and graduated from Columbus Catholic High School in 1975. He married Bridget Lichty on May 14, 1976. In lieu of flowers, the family requests memorials be sent to the Sailor Youth Sports Programs or the Northeast Iowa Food Bank in Tim's honor. Funeral services celebrating the life of Timothy Knipp will take place on March 23rd at Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church in Waterloo. Visitation will begin at 9:30 a.m. with a funeral mass at 10:30 a.m. A luncheon will follow at the Elks Club in Waterloo with a burial to follow. George Clive Cook passed away Friday morning, February 23rd, at the Views of Marion. A celebration of life will be held at 1:30 p.m. on Sunday, March 24th, at Murdoch Funeral and Cremation Service in Marion. Irene Mae Weidman was born January 20th, 1950, in Olwine. She died March 14th at Every Step Cavanaugh House in Des Moines from ovarian cancer. A private family service will be held at a later date. Irene lived on a farm for 13 years and helped with farm work and driving tractor while baling hay. She moved to the town of Maynard and helped her parents at their downtown restaurant for many years. Irene was involved in the churches she attended and volunteered at Denver Elementary School as a teacher's aide and at Greater Love Ministries in Madrid. Memorial gifts can be given to Polycystic Kidney Disease Foundation and 5P-. Stephen Vernon Davenport, known as Wakakitaga, 71, of Waterloo, passed away Sunday, March 17th at North Crest Specialty Care in Waterloo. A traditional wake will be held Monday, March 18th at the Eagle Clan Ceremonial Building on the Meskwaki Settlement. A traditional graveside service will be held Tuesday, March 19th at 3 p.m. at the Garden of Memories in Waterloo. Stephen was born on August 23, 1952, in Marshalltown. He graduated from East High School in Waterloo and attended Scott Community College and the University of Northern Iowa. Stephen served his country in the U.S. Army. Stephen had many occupations over the years, of which his favorite was a cable installment mechanic. He enjoyed working on cars, riding motorcycles, taking walks, and fishing. Miriam Krollman, 98, died Friday, March 15th at Deary Suites of Western Home Communities. Miriam was born December 29th, 1925, at Spencer, Indiana. She was baptized on May 4th, 1947, and confirmed on June 7th, 1951. She married Walter Krollman on January 30th of 51 at Yankton, South Dakota. Miriam graduated from Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana, with a Bachelor of Arts degree in education. She taught elementary school for 7 years and then served as parish secretary at College Hill Lutheran Church for 20 years. Memorial services will be 11 a.m. Saturday, March 23rd at College Hill Lutheran Church, Cedar Falls, with a visitation 1 hour before the service. Interment at Forest Hill Cemetery, Greencastle, Indiana, at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the church or Western Home Foundation. And now we continue with some more Cedar Falls news. Residents of a small neighborhood in the southeastern part of town registered their worries about a proposed use for the Scent Church, and one before the applicant even came before a city panel. The Board of Adjustment had been expecting Tuesday to hear and possibly rule that night on the conditional use application of James and Madison Gorman. They were seeking to open up an event center in the 5,100 square foot of sanctuary space they had agreed to take over as part of a purchase of the church building at 5625 Prairie Street. The couple, however, withdrew the application the day before the meeting, according to planner Thomas Weintraut. The case had been triggered by the desire to reuse the institutional building for the hospitality-oriented use, which it qualifies for in city code. However, the Community Development Department recommended certain conditions be set that warranted approval from the board. The pushback from most, if not the entire neighborhood of some 20 dwellings, was one of the main reasons for the applicant reversing course, Weintraut said. An email and call were left for the Gormans late Tuesday, but not immediately returned. Weintraut said they have no plans to use that site now for its business and may pivot to somewhere else. Reasons for the pushback had to do with an expected increase in people and vehicles to the area. I was shocked, said Jeff Denny, a resident speaking about the applicant's decision from his doorstep to the east of the church. Life doesn't usually go this way. The change of plans renders sense purchase agreement with the Gormans void and represents a second setback for the church. The congregation saw its future home, the former Grace Community Church at the corner of Greenhill and Hudson Roads, catch fire last month. The blaze caused what Daniel Quinby, lead pastor at St. Church, described Tuesday as significant damage, which delayed its moving plans. We'll see what happens, says Quinby. We're excited to see what God has in store and how he weaves all this together. The Prairie Road building off Cedar Heights Drive has been known as St. Church since 2021, but for a long time it had been Cornerstone Fellowship Church, said the pastor. Before that, it was First Brethren Church, according to the city. Last year, the Board of Adjustment approved two other conditional uses for applicants wanting to reuse old church buildings, as allowed within Chapter 26-140 of the City Code, with approval from the Board. New owners and tenants of the former Jordan Crossing Church, 209 Walnut Street, and First Church of Christ Scientist Building, 701 West 6th Street, were successful in their applications. However, both needed an additional code change granted by the City Council for a new category of acceptable use known as personal service as a future salon and therapeutic center, respectively. The Fear was a future event center attracting up to 200 people for family and business functions, meant more cars parked on both sides of the narrow streets for more days and hours of the week than the congregation had attracted through its normal use. Both Ferris and Denny never spoke to the Gormans and expressed their opposition after receiving notice from the city of the application and proposed use. Close to 20 people signed a petition and gave it to the city, according to the document obtained by the courier from Weintraut. St. Church has relisted the property. Since the original posting last month, it has received a lot of interest from businesses and churches as well, as other parties that want to convert it to housing, said Quinby. He emphasized his understanding of the concerns from the residents. The original structure dates back to more than 50 years ago, with a large addition dating back to the 1990s. But the pastor said his congregation and past ones have kept it in good condition and felt it will be a blessing for the city and whomever eventually uses it. The building spans 9,000 square feet and includes a parsonage on the property, taking up more than 5 acres. Weintraut said the Gormans had no plans to change the footprint. The reason for the move is Grace Community congregants merging with St. Church, bringing the total membership to 300 to 400 people some 3 months ago, and now needing a larger space. That bigger building is Grace Communities at 4421 Hudson Road. The building's street facing end caught fire last month while renovations were being made to the space. That necessitated a complete reconstruction of the damaged portion, pushing the congregation's expected move from this week to likely the end of the year. 6 chefs are expected to contend for the Best Dish title on April 4th at Chefs Take a Stand, the 10th anniversary event that raises funds for Friends of the Family. This year's event takes place at the Hilton Garden Inn in Cedar Falls, presented by the Waverly Exchange Club and Green State Credit Union, beginning at 6 p.m. Those attending the event can taste dishes prepared by local chefs and sample beverages from four local beverage vendors. It's a great opportunity for the Cedar Valley to come together to taste some really great food and drinks from our vendors. It's all to stand up for and raise funds for ending homelessness and supporting victims of violent crime, said Sarah Pavlik, Communications and Events Manager for Friends of the Family. Money raised from the event helps fund Friends of the Family programs dedicated to helping people in crisis due to domestic violence, sexual assault, human trafficking, and homelessness. For more than 30 years, Friends of the Family has worked to create housing solutions through housing assistance and case management services, as well as advocacy and services for victims. Serving 25 Iowa counties, the organization works to ensure that each person in crisis due to homelessness or who is a survivor of crime has access to support and services needed to find a safe place to call home. Organizers hope to raise $25,000. Besides being a really fun event, it's an opportunity for the community to be part of something bigger and make sure we can continue to provide the services we do, Pavlik explained. Tickets are available for $35 and can be purchased online at FOFIA.org. Chef Jamie Dare from Wartburg College won Best Dish at last year's event and will defend her title with her special take on a BLT. She'll be competing against Dan and Katie Corbett from Hungry Charlie's, Clint Stowe from Here's to You, Tyler Manier from Gilmore's Pub, Western Home Communities, and Aaron Brochard from Blue Barn Barbecue. Last year's beverage vendor and best drink winner, Happy's Wine and Spirits, is returning with a Mulberry Cosmopolitan. Other participating beverage vendors are Second State Brewing, Single Speed Brewing, and Bremer Brewing Company. Competitors receive a cutting board engraved with their names. Silent and live auctions will feature items donated by Cedar Valley businesses. There is no formal presentation, but staff members will share stories and thoughts on how funds raised will impact their services and programs, Pavlik said. And now to some UNI sports. The Northern Iowa women left it all on the floor. After an emblematic loss to Drake in the Missouri Valley Conference semifinals, in which the Panthers rallied to erase a double-digit deficit and force overtime, head coach Tanya Warren highlighted the resilience of her team. "They played their hearts out all weekend," Warren said. "It is what we have done all year long, with all things considered. They were just a resilient group of people all year long." During her media availability on Monday, Warren continued to point out how it provided an example of the way her team had handled challenge after challenge and injury after injury during a up-and-down 23-24 campaign. However, for you and I to make an extended run and build momentum into the off-season, Warren said the Panthers must move beyond hurting. However, for you and I to make an extended run, the Panthers' appearance in the WNIT gives the UNI women 9 consecutive postseason appearances under Warren, excluding the 2019-2020 season, during which postseason tournaments were not held due to the COVID-19 pandemic. After receiving a first-round bye, the Panthers will face the winner of a matchup between St. Louis and Central Arkansas on Thursday at 6:30 p.m. The exact date, time, and location of the Panthers' second-round matchup has not yet been determined, but it will take place between Saturday, March 23rd and Tuesday, March 26th. The McLeod Center is not an option to host a first- and second-round game due to scheduling conflicts. And in wrestling, Northern Iowa head coach Doug Schwab figures Ryder Downey will have more to say after the NCAA Division I wrestling championships. After listening in on a pre-NCAA tournament press conference Monday where Downey did not have much to say, Schwab surmises Downey is content on letting his wrestling do the talking. To date, Downey's wrestling has said a lot. UNI's redshirt freshman from Indianola enters Thursday's start of the national tournament at the T-Mobile Center on a 14-match win streak, which has earned him the number 5 seed at 157 pounds. At 24, Downey has not lost since December 19th at the collegiate duels when he dropped a 7-6 match to Ed Scott of North Carolina State, this week's number 4 seed at 157. Downey will open his first NCAA tournament against Oklahoma's Jared Hill, an opponent he beat 13-1 in their only matchup this season. Asked what it would take for him to duplicate the success he has had over the second half of the season, Downey was short and to the point. "Nothing more than what it has taken me so far this season," he said. Downey was a solid prospect in the state of Iowa his senior year in 21-22. He was three-time state medalist, finishing 7th, 2nd, and 4th during his career at Indianola, where his dad, Jared, won state titles in 1990 and 91. In a matter of seconds, he went from solid prospect to the hottest prospect in the state of Iowa. After going 14-5 during his first winter in Cedar Falls, Downey won his first 5 matches this season, including victories over then number 10 Trevor Chumbly of Northwestern and number 13 Patty Gallagher of Ohio State at the Las Vegas Cliff Keen Invitational in Las Vegas. After a loss to Gallagher and Scott, Downey has been unbeaten and has done it displaying his tenacious riding ability. Schwab says Downey has earned the 5th seed, but at the same time feels the rest of the nation continues to sleep on Downey. Downey's road to the podium in Kansas City will not be easy. That can be said about every wrestler in every weight class, but the 157 field is loaded, in particular in the top half of the bracket where Downey resides. The top half includes 7 past All-Americans, Penn State's Levi Haynes, Missouri's Brock Mahler at 149, Michigan's Will Lewin, Nebraska's Peyton Robb, Virginia Tech's Bryce Andonian, Minnesota's Michael Blockhus at 149, and Scott from North Carolina State. Parker Kikkonen is looking to become UNI's first 4-time Division I All-American. In winning the Big 12 title, he beat fellow freshman and Iowa State's Cody Chittum. For the second time in a match that amazed everybody, the 5-3 victory took 12 minutes to complete, and it was a riding time point awarded to Downey that forced overtime. If you're looking for something to do, the Cedar Valley Fashion, Art, and Culture Expo will host a denim disaster event March 30th. The event is an immersive experience for attendees featuring a fusion of fashion, art, and local talent. It will showcase a diverse range of artists, designers, and vendors, highlighting the rich cultural tapestry of the region. The doors open at 6 p.m. and the show starts at 7 p.m. at the Waterloo Convention Center. Tickets for the event are on sale with options available for general admission and VIP access. General admission includes access to all exhibits and entertainment, while VIP tickets offer VIP sitting, seating, cocktails, and VIP parking. General admission tickets are $20 and VIP tickets cost $65. Tickets can be purchased at Eventbrite. The Cedar Falls Lions Club will host its annual Dan Steele Memorial Pancake Day from 7 a.m. to noon Saturday at Pete Junior High School. All-you-can-eat pancakes are $7 for adults and $3 for children under 8. Tickets are available in advance from any Lions member or at the event. Pancakes will be served in both a drive-through and eat-in. The Lions also will be hosting their second annual pickleball tournament at Pete Junior High at the same time. Proceeds from the events support KidSight, eye screening, diabetes prevention, and hearing aid assistance. The Cedar Valley Stamp Club meeting will be at 7 p.m. Wednesday at the Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa building. There will be a club auction of collectible stamps. The meeting is open to visitors. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, March 21st, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.
In Africa, 5-year-old Charu has no choice. She and millions like her must walk miles every day for dirty water. But together, we can end their walk by providing clean water close by. Instead of spending hours walking to get water that makes them sick, girls can be in a classroom that expands their minds, and moms will gain back time to care for their families. Sons and daughters can grow up strong, finally free of sicknesses caused by dirty water. At World Vision, care about clean water runs deep. Deep enough to reach one new person with clean water every 10 seconds. Because every child, every person, everywhere deserves clean water and the chance to rise to their full potential. It's true. When you just add water, you change a life. Learn more at worldvision.org.